Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. Today, our episode explores navigating spondyloarthritis in the workplace, balancing work, health, and wellness. We have two guests today, the first being Patricia Grabarek, PhD, who is the co-founder of Worker Being and a seasoned industrial organizational psychologist specializing in workplace wellness, organizational culture, employee engagement, diversity and inclusion, and leadership development. With a background in consulting and internal roles, Dr. Grabarek has led people analytics and talent management initiatives for more than 60 organizations across various industries. Her work is focused on research-based strategies to improve well-being, retention, performance, and diversity efforts. She was named one of CultureAmp's top 25 emerging culture creators for 2024, and her insights have appeared in the LA Times, CBS News, and CBC Radio. She holds a PhD and MS in industrial organizational psychology from Penn State and a Bachelor of Arts in psychology from UCLA. Also joining us is Dr. Katina Sawyer. She is the co-founder of Worker Being and an associate professor of management and organizations at the University of Arizona's Eller College of Management, a leading expert in work-life balance, leadership, positive workplace behaviors, and diversity. She has published more than 50 peer-reviewed studies, book chapters, and articles in outlets like Harvard Business Review. Her work has been featured in major media such as The Washington Post, Bloomberg Businessweek, The Atlantic, and Forbes. She's received grants from the National Science Foundation and the Society for Human Resource Management for her groundbreaking research that has established her as a thought leader in positive workplace behaviors. She's among Philadelphia Business Journal's top 40 under 40 in 2017. She also consults with organizations offering data-driven solutions to create healthier, more productive workplaces. She holds a BA in psychology from Villanova University and a dual PhD and MS in industrial organizational psychology and women's studies from Penn State. Ladies, welcome to SpondyCast. I'm super excited for this.
Thank you. So are
we. Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, this is great. So you started a company called Worker Being and a book that's coming up soon called Leading for Wellness. Can we talk a little bit about how you guys got to that spot?
Sure. Yes. So Katina and I met in grad school. As you heard in the bios, we both went to Penn State and we spent a lot of time there studying what makes workplaces effective and thriving and healthy. And then we went off into the real world, right? Katina went into academia. I went into practice. And one year we got together at a friend's wedding and we started lamenting the fact that all this great research on workplace wellness was just not getting to organizations, right? There were a lot of challenges that people were facing in these companies and not any real answers. So we thought, what can we do about that? How can we help organizations actually learn how to truly create healthy environments? So we started Worker Being, first with the intent of just sharing research, right? There's a lot of great research that's behind a paywall in these academic journals that you also have to be trained to learn how to read and analyze and understand. So we started with a blog, just sharing takeaways and breaking down that research for folks, moved that into a podcast, and then started working with organizations coming in and educating folks on how we can actually create healthier work environments. All of that led us to our book because when we were diving into this research so deeply and sharing a lot with folks, we learned quickly that there was a gap. We see great research of a million different things that you can do to make a healthy environment. But if I'm a leader that wants to make a change today, what do I do? There are so many different options. And we thought it'd be important for us to kind of close that gap in the literature and do some research and understand what are the key behaviors of leaders that drive healthy, effective work environments where people can really thrive. And can we build a blueprint from that? So we conducted that research on our own and then turned it into our book that's coming out on March 25th. We're super excited to share it with the world. We're hoping that people can take that and leaders can take the first step to create the right healthy environment.
I love that. And I think there's a lot of, for anyone listening probably who's been in the workplace, there's a lot of good intent around wellness and employees, but then it does, I would agree, it falls off after the research. And I'll say some of it is right because it's in a social science and you're trying to bring it into an organization and that creates a gap. So we're glad you guys are here filling that gap. What does a wellness-focused workplace look like for people who might be managing a chronic condition like spondyloarthritis?
Yeah. So in our research, we asked a lot of questions and actually started with a very basic question, which was what does wellness mean to employees? Because we were seeing a gap between what companies were offering and what employees were finding helpful. And generally, what we have found companies do with wellness solutions is sort of this spaghetti at the wall approach, where they have a budget for wellness and they're spending it on things and they're hoping that the things they're spending it on hit the largest number of people to be, you know, effective. But that often means it's not hitting anybody's specific or unique need, right? And so often what employees are saying is, you know, yeah, I have access to some resources and those things are kind of interesting, you know, mindfulness at lunch, something like that, right? But what I really want is for my leader to understand my specific individualized wellness challenges and to help me to figure out a way to navigate those at work. And this would be the same thing for a chronic condition. And in fact, in our book, we've interviewed several people. And in our survey research to follow up on those interviews, we had several people, or, you know, more than several, who were managing chronic conditions. And one of the things that was really helpful for them was to be able to have the conversation with their leader about these conditions. So as a leader, setting an environment where people are able to come to you and have those honest dialogues and not feel judged or not feel like people are going to think you're going to perform less well or not think that you're going to be less valuable as an employee. And then also to ask for solutions. What would be helpful? And to work with the employees to, as closely as they can, come up with solutions that will match the challenges they're facing.
I love it. So if, say I have spondyloarthritis, how can you give me some tips and tricks on how I might communicate what I need to my employer?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think what's really important when you're starting to have these conversations is to start small. If you have a great relationship with your leader, then, you know, obviously this doesn't apply, right? Go ahead, start talking about what you need and how they can support you if you already have built that relationship. If you don't have a strong relationship with your leader, if it's a new leader, if you haven't tested the waters in this topic before, start with something small and build from there. See how they react. See what their initial response is so you know how safe the environment is. It's obviously really difficult to bring up challenges when you don't have a supportive leader. And we don't want to recommend that someone just goes and shares everything if they have a leader that's not going to be helpful. But assuming you have a well-intentioned leader, start something small. You know, you don't have to disclose everything. And we don't encourage people to disclose things that they're not comfortable with, but, you know, you can mention that you have some chronic health issues that you're dealing with and coping with, and that you are wanting to find solutions where you're able to be the most productive you can be based on the way things work for you, right? So just kind of even bringing it up that you're trying to figure out how to schedule things best because you really want to be productive for them can start opening up the dialogue and then seeing how they react, right? To any suggestions you might have around maybe needing some flexibility or going to a doctor's appointment or whatever that looks like for you. Once you see that they're responding effectively, the more you're able to open up and share the experience and educate the person, and hopefully the person's asking questions and being curious about what you're dealing with, the more they can actually help and support you, right? So I think the first step is just testing the waters and then slowly building deeper communication, deeper conversations, and helping educate the leader so they understand what you're coping with and they can work with you directly to create a better environment.
Yeah. And I'm going to throw a bit of a weeds curveball, but how do you see this fitting into the larger inclusive workplace? I mean, as somebody who has had to share or felt the need to share it with a leader and someone who now leads, I lead a company and I talk about it too. Sometimes I say, I'm not typing anymore today, guys, because my fingers hurt and my wrists are on fire. So be inclusive. If you want to be inclusive, then let me off the hook for my typos. But how does this fit into that larger? Because it's often an unseen disease for a lot of us, and I think a lot of the listeners.
Yeah, we often talk about this in the book. And I think what it really comes down to is creating an environment that is stigma-free around both physical and mental health conditions that people might experience. We talk about both in the book. And I think really it's been taboo for a long time in certain work environments to bring up these issues because we have what other researchers, we didn't coin this term, but call the ideal worker norm, which is basically the sense that we've inherited these norms about what it is to be a good employee. And the good employee is always on and never takes breaks and is relentlessly giving all their time and energy to the workplace. And that's just not true for anybody. Nobody can sustain that. And the leaders themselves can't sustain that. Even leaders who drive teams like that, they actually don't end up liking or benefiting from those environments themselves. So we're trying to really push towards a deconstruction of those ideal worker norms and creating workplaces where that stigma around facing these challenges so that, yeah, you might need a break at some point during the day, but perhaps during your focus time, you're twice as focused as somebody else because you know you're on a limited clock for the amount of time you might be able to engage in a particular activity, right? So it's not necessarily that these activities or having to take additional breaks or having these additional considerations makes people less productive, but the stigma comes when people erroneously make those assumptions, right? That it automatically has to mean that your performance takes a hit.
Right.
I think one thing.
Go ahead.
I was going to say one thing that you said that I want to highlight is the fact that you share openly with your team is exactly what we would recommend people to do. Like that is huge because it helps to alleviate that stigma, right? You're talking about these issues, you're really open to it. So then people know that you're not going to judge them if they have an issue or a struggle. So I think it's very important to try to create an environment where people are able to talk about what they're dealing with so that they can all support each other, but also to kind of reduce that stigma.
Yeah. And listen, I know it's not easy. I mean, when I finally did the reveal. It was 2 years of a boss who was so supportive. And I finally one day said, I feel like we're in a relationship and I've been lying to you for two plus years. And mine, I was very lucky to have that support. And I know people who it hasn't gone well or that there can be a stigma around it. My only thing was the next morning I was in the gym running and he was like, are you sure you should be running? And I said, that is none of your business. Okay. So we'll move on from inclusion because I think it is an important piece for a lot of people. But with that, so, and I think a lot of people with a chronic condition, especially AS, want to do this because movement is one of the best things for our disease. But how do you communicate or align, you know, what you want to do from a wellness perspective with work and staying out of that constant flare cycle?
Yeah. So boundaries are really important for everybody in the workplace, right? There's things that you need to do and manage in your personal life, for your personal wellness and health and well-being. And as Katina was mentioning early, what employees want from a well-being perspective is very individual to themselves. And the organizations providing these different resources and things, like while they could be beneficial if someone wants to take advantage, what we really need to be focusing on is giving people the time to do the things they need to do to take care of themselves in whatever way they need to take care of themselves, because it of course varies by person, especially if you're dealing with chronic illness. There's a lot of things that you might be managing that other people are not, and you need to be given the time and the flexibility to manage it. So what we recommend is creating strict boundaries and being very, very selective as to what can cross through that boundary, right? So we've been talking a lot about like imagining at a club, a velvet rope, right? Who's going to get in, who's not? Is something actually going to pass that boundary because it's so urgent, so important? Then maybe it does cross through. But if you do that, then there's expectation, right? That person, that thing that you were working on is going to be important enough moving forward, right? They're going to be that person that thinks they're VIP every single time because you let them cross that boundary. So trying to create boundaries, clearly communicating those boundaries, explaining, you know, even to your leader or your colleagues, like why that boundary is so important to you, and then sticking to it is so crucial so that you can make sure you have the time and the space to do what you need to do to take care of your wellness.
Do you think it in the workplace that is a primary reason people sort of spiral out of a routine or focusing on their own wellness? The lack of boundaries?
It can be. It can be, yeah. And while working remotely has tons of benefits and has tons of benefits for managing chronic conditions as well, there are some boundary related issues that occur for individuals working from home because your work and your home are the same location. And while that can be helpful at times from a task perspective or you have the things that you need to feel healthy and happy in your environment, it can also give people the green light that, you know, well, that's where you usually take your Zoom calls from. So why not take one at, you know, 8:30 at night or whatever the case may be? It makes people's assumptions about when and where you work change a little bit. And so it becomes even more important to assert those boundaries because it can, as you're saying, when you start to get into the pattern, because that's also a pattern, right? A pattern of saying, yes, you can cross this boundary. Yes, I'm available to take that call. Yes, I'm going to answer every email that comes in after hours because I feel pressure to be responsive to them. That then people learn that, well, that's the boundary. And then that becomes the routine, right? That boundary transgression becomes the routine. So you can spiral out, like you're saying, out of a routine that's healthy for you by, you know, making a new routine, which is, yeah, it's okay to cross boundaries. And one thing I think is really interesting that I heard, and this is not something that's in our book, but one of my friends said this to me and it always stuck with me. Starting a new job or starting in a new organization or starting in a new position is a great time to renegotiate your boundaries because people don't know them yet. So if you're like, oh, I wish I never like said yes to answering emails off hours or people didn't expect that. If you just say, I'm not available after X time and I get to things after that time in the morning, then you're able to renegotiate those boundaries. So think about when those moments are that you might be able to reassert a boundary that's been broken too.
Oh, yeah. I'm having my own personal situation. I struggle with that. And I think a lot of us do. Let mm-hmm. me ask you this. I think there's, and I think in general, we tend toward like the conversations around workplaces, offices. But like, what if you're in a physical job or a frontline worker, or manufacturing worker, dealing with a chronic disease where you being attentive to a machine or, you know, having to keep a product going or a line going, like what, how do you handle that? Cause I know that that has, I've seen that create, friction among, you know, frontline workers.
Yeah. I'd love to hear a little bit more when you say friction, because somebody needs to step back for a minute and their team is then impacted.
Yeah. So, you know, somebody who might need to not be standing in front of a CNC machine for 8 hours, but they need someone to come in from a safety perspective, someone come in so that they can actually like go and move their joints a bit. There was one I had in a organization I worked in, and as it turned out, he did have spondylitis. And we were trying to really be supportive. And I think until people understood, but then you don't want the whole office or factory to know that you have a chronic disease. And like, mm-hmm. how do you support, do you see it as any different? Cause I think there is a difference from what I've seen from frontline to professional, you know, office, big building workers.
Yeah, there's definitely a difference because the way boundaries work, the way you support people and their wellness is just going to naturally vary because of the type of job, the nature of the job, the hours that have to be worked, and usually hourly employees versus salaried, right? With the flexibility might be a little bit different. So I do think it is a little bit of a challenge when you're in that situation and trying to figure out how do you manage and not let everyone know the situation. I think that's going to be the hardest piece, right? If you don't want everyone to know, how do you keep it a little bit more contained? One thought that comes to mind for me is, you know, if the employee knows exactly kind of what that time frame looks like, right? I need to be moving X amount of times per hour, per, 8 hours, whatever that is. There might be possibilities to figure out how to manage breaks differently, right? Within the legal bounds. I know there's a lot of legal bounds around breaks, but can this person have a different break schedule maybe than others? I've seen organizations where somebody would come in like a little bit earlier, a little bit later than the rest of the shift because of some of the challenges that they have. So then they overlap a little bit with the later shift and then they are able to take an additional break as the shifts change. So thinking through like, how can we make this schedule work for the person? Or maybe there's a way of scheduling them so that maybe it's not a full 8 hours at once, but a shorter burst and then a bit of a break and a shorter burst, which might be hard to manage personal life within that. But that has been something I've seen before.
Interesting. Yeah. I think, and it's difficult no matter where you're at. I think if you're trying to deal with this. And I also think there's a hesitation among employees that if I share, I'm going to get fired, or if I share, and as an employer, even when people share with me, I often stop the details at some point, like, what do you need? But we'll, you know, I don't need to know every detail of what's going on. And mm-hmm. I think some of this too, people look at it, it's like almost a compliance thing or a risk from an employer standpoint, which is, I think, unfortunate. And I've had bosses previously who've said to me, am I talking to Jill, like the person I'm hanging out with, or am I talking to Jill, the employee? And it's really interesting. I do think there's a little bit of fear from a lot of employers and leaders, which is some of the good work you're doing, I'm sure, is removing those barriers. Okay. So stress is something that just infiltrates a lot of places in the workplace. But particularly, we know stress leads to flares in something like spondyloarthritis. If the stress is increasing in a particular role or situation, like what is the best way to quickly convey it and I think dissipate what's going on?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of what we talk about in the book is about these ongoing conversations between leaders and followers. So getting those conversations going and starting to get into a pattern of having these conversations. I mean, to be clear, we believe in structural changes within organizations to support employee wellness, right? And so what we're talking a lot about here is, okay, you're in a structure. How do you advocate kind of from the bottom up a little bit? The hope is that you'll have a leader who is open to these dialogues and conversations. But if you have these ongoing dialogues, it becomes a lot easier to flag some of these issues as they crop up because you're already in a cadence or a pattern of talking and sharing things with one another, and stress falls into one of those categories, right? So as you're in conversation with your leader about various things that are going on with you at work, as well as, we hope, outside of work, that you're able to share more of the life challenges that you're facing, hopefully it becomes natural to flag up when you have too much on your plate, when things are getting overwhelming. And as leaders, the hope is that people will actually be checking in proactively to try to make sure that they're assigning work in a way that's not going to result in overwork and overload for their employees. But it does happen. As you said, stress is everywhere. Every job has its stressors. But being able to really flag and saying, you know, I'm feeling like there's too much on my plate, or there's a particular relationship or a particular client that I find really stressful. Is there a way that we can figure out how to deal with this so that I don't go from, you know, maybe I'm usually at a 30 and I'm at a 50 and I don't want to go to a 75, right? How do we sort of de-escalate before we get to the point of an emergency? And those ongoing open dialogues can help with that.
Interesting. The employee once you leave work and you go home. Any advice for how to split work life from home life? And are there, you know, are there trade-offs?
Yeah. So there's a lot of variability in how people prefer to split work and life. But in a situation where you really want to divide work and life, there's a couple of recovery tactics that you can consider. This is important for everybody. So when you go home from work and you're trying to figure out how can I recover from the stress I'm dealing with, how can I help myself re-energize and kind of fill my cup, if you will, before I have to go back into work the next day. The top recovery tactic that most people don't think about when they're thinking about recovery. Most people are thinking about things like relaxation, right? Like watching some Netflix and binging TV, or maybe going for a walk, which all those things are really great. But mastery is the key recovery tactic if you want to really replenish your resources before you have to go in and deal with stressors again at work the next day. What is mastery?
Yes.
It's learning something new. So doing something after work where you're learning something that's meaningful to you, that's different from work, that's new to you, that is huge. It's, you get this sense of accomplishment and excitement that can help boost your energy and reduce exhaustion and stress. So maybe you like to cook. It's learning how to make a new recipe. Or if you're a baker, you've now learned how to decorate like a cake differently. Or you're really interested in learning a new language, and so you've started working on that. And you know, whenever you remember the words, then you start to feel that level of mastery that you're learning something new and interesting to yourself. And that is massively helpful for recovery. So thinking about what it is that you might want to learn outside of work and spending time at least, you know, once a week, a couple times a week to do that thing and really learn and educate yourself in something different can be helpful.
That's fascinating. And, you know, and maybe it's, it, maybe it's the same research I read a couple years ago about people who perform best at work throughout the year, despite, you know, like when they go on vacation. There are people who go on vacation and do something that they learn while they're on vacation, and then they come back and they're much more refreshed as opposed to just sitting on the beach for a week, which isn't bad either. So I want to go in a place a little bit. And in the book, I think you talk about this, and we're seeing it like globally right now, right? Employee engagement, I think, is at 35% roughly, mm-hmm. I'm seeing. And I think Gallup had a poll recently that said the cost of it is about $9 trillion globally, which is crazy.
Yeah.
For employers, I mean, I know that you had mentioned at the top of the hour that employers often implement something from a wellness perspective and it doesn't work. When they get it right, and they've worked with employees to define it, what are the tangible benefits of that for an employer?
Yeah, we heard a lot in our interviews and in our survey data, but we also know this from a huge body of decades of research that when employees are happier and healthier, many good things happen for organizations. The first, as you just mentioned, they're more engaged. Employees can be more engaged when they have more energy to dedicate to their job. And they have more motivation and, you know, willingness to put in that time and energy to really dive in deep. As a result, you know, engagement is related to many different things, performance, productivity. So we see both a link to, you know, bottom line outcomes through engagement, as well as through other things like commitment, positive feelings about their employer and their leader, like a net promoter score, right? Where they're more likely to say positive things to others about the place that they work. Turnover, are they likely to stay long within the organization? Are they constantly looking for other opportunities? You know, if that phone rings, I'm gone, right? That's a different mentality than someone who's very committed to the job and is not intending to leave. And that also has an impact. The strongest predictor, not shockingly, of whether people leave is whether they want to leave. So if there are a lot of people looking for jobs, there are probably going to be a lot of people who are leaving your organization soon. And so when people feel happy and healthy, they give their all to their job, but they're also more likely to want to stay and be in that work environment and value that work environment. And they tell others and they act accordingly.
Interesting. And Do you think, as you've worked with organizations, because I think some of this is interesting for even listeners to take back to their employers around, you talked about bottom up a bit, and I've always been a troublemaker in every organization I was ever in. So I'm assuming there are some more troublemakers.
We love that.
In the audience. How do companies or organizations modify well-being strategies, say for, again, like, you know, the team that's in Manhattan versus the team that's in Salina, Kansas? Or is that something that has to be relatively localized from a well-being perspective? Or is it more just giving people what they need individually?
We really focus on the individual as kind of the target audience for wellness solutions and programs, right? Because ultimately, somebody in Kansas, somebody in Manhattan, somebody in Seoul, Korea, right? They all can have the same issues. They could all have something very different. Location, how they work remote, hybrid, on site, all those things matter less than the individual person's needs and what their specific situation requires. So the best thing organizations can do is at the very, very top, right? The senior leadership buying into this idea of supporting employees. That's the first thing that needs to happen. Create a value around employees first. Talk about that all the time. Those leaders need to be role modeling good behaviors, both from a work-life balance perspective and how they lead their own teams. Then the next layer of leaders need to get involved, right? They need to buy into this. They need to start practicing some of these good behaviors. So training and educating leaders is crucial. But then each leader is kind of in charge of their own team in terms of how to support, right? Sometimes they might need to reach out to the people team or their leadership to get additional things involved, right? Resources, whatever they might need to support somebody. But as a leader, your job is to know your direct reports, know them well, understand them, and bring them in to help you solution as a partnership for any things that they might be facing. So we really encourage people to think about this cultural norm of getting to know people, having meaningful relationships, helping each other out, supporting each other, and then that leader's job is to really drive that home.
Interesting. And you're talking about moving for some organizations from the status quo into this new norm, which is more inclusive or helps everyone sort of be part of the who are we at work, and we're all the same. We're all the same family. I like that. So if you are someone wanting to advocate for yourself or advocate for changes across the work environment, like, is there a good approach, and maybe you're not just looking at yourself, but you're seeing others around you having similar concerns. How do you do that? Do you go to HR?
Yeah, I think, you know, we talk about this a bit because there's a chapter on challenges and backlash in our book about when you do things differently. Obviously, it's very helpful to have a workplace environment that promotes these activities, right? Where leaders and the culture, you know, is with you instead of against you. And it's more about you bringing these things up and being, you know, vocal. But once you're being vocal, it's being accepted. It's very different to be in an environment where you feel like the culture may be either questionable, you're not sure how people are going to respond, or you know that you might face some negativity or challenges. And so in those situations, it can be really helpful to find champions, people in the organization who you know you can trust, you know, preferably someone who has some power and influence, to talk with them and ask if they might be willing to partner with you or work alongside you or put together a team or a task force that might be able to help you address these issues more broadly. So maybe it's not just about your specific issue, but it could be about issues like this that many people in the workplace are experiencing, or it could be physical health issues in general, or it could be physical and mental health issues, or a focus, or just a greater focus on wellness. Who's in the organization who's like-minded, who you think would work with you on this, so that it's not just your voice alone, but rather you're putting together a team of people who share similar concerns, who feel passionately about this. And then a group is a lot harder to ignore and a lot harder to vilify than one person, one squeaky wheel, right? So we do recommend thinking about and being strategic about finding champions.
And, you know, they say it only takes 3% of a population to create a movement.
Yeah.
If you can build your army.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So, and what about people who maybe, and I think this is a common barrier. People who are hesitant, or there is a fear around speaking up, because there are a lot of organizations still that speaking up isn't even welcome.
Yeah. I think that's where obviously working with champions, finding champions would be helpful, finding allies that are not people that are dealing with the same chronic health issues as you are, or mental health issues as you are, whatever you're dealing with, that are inclusive can help too, right? So an ally that is not, they're not experiencing the same challenges. So maybe they are not going to face the same consequences because they're now speaking up for this broader audience of people that are not them, right? So if there's backlash against them, it's not against them directly. So it's a little bit safer for them to speak up as if they're an ally, which, I mean, allies in all sorts of diversity, equity, and inclusion type topics are important, right? And this is one of them. And I think one thing those allies can do, or going to like an HR team, a people team, is thinking about how can we bring awareness and education around the challenges people face. There's a lot of research that shows that once people are exposed to these challenges and understand them better, they start to have more empathy for it. They start to be more willing to address it. So part of it is just trying to find a way to bring education, and whether that's through like lunch and learns or different events within the organization where you can start to share broader challenges that people face that don't have to be individual people on the team, and having allies or HR champion some of that can really help get that in front of folks to start to slowly change the stigma and the lack of awareness that might be causing people to be hesitant.
Okay. It sounds like a good plan. Can I, I'm going to ask you a question that maybe am battled with emotion at the moment, but in terms of the DEI movements and the shifts back and forth in our country lately, are you seeing it affect workplace? Number one, are you seeing it affecting workplaces where people don't have the ability to speak up? And, or, you know, I have a suspicion in some workplaces there's more empathy than ever before, but how do you see that playing out for people with chronic, maybe sometimes invisible diseases that still need the DEI support?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And, you know, I've taught classes on DEI for like almost 15 years now to students at all different levels, and also done work in organizations in this space, very, very heavily invested in this question. So thank you for asking. And yes, it's been really challenging to navigate these uncertain, I think, waters, because organizations are trying to figure out how to make sense of these things. And many organizations have not even released a formal plan for how they're going to make sense of these things. Other organizations have, you know, made decisions more quickly. And, you know, some have made decisions that are more extreme. I mean, corporations, private corporations are not required to abide by these executive orders, right? And so some organizations have decided to take it upon themselves to react, even though they're not, they don't have to. Others are kind of waiting to see how things shake out, and others have doubled down on their commitments. So I think right now it's a little bit of a Wild West scenario, right? In terms of what's been going on. I think one thing that is potentially helpful is that I don't know that all of the folks who are anti-DEI really understand all of what DEI encompasses. And I have not heard a lot of people, for example, saying we shouldn't have ADA accommodations. I don't think that that's really always controversial as some of the other things. So we're sort of like throwing, you know, things out that people don't even realize are under this umbrella. I saw a conversation going on online where someone posted, these are all the things that we have because of ADA accommodations, like sidewalk accommodations, things that help, you know, sidewalk accommodations for wheelchairs actually ended up helping moms and dads with strollers, right? Like, these are things that can have bigger, broader impacts on the community. And I don't know that people have really thought through all of the implications of what falls under that umbrella. So my hope is that over time, as people realize, whoa, DEI actually encompasses way more stuff than we thought, that there will be some, changes in the way that people are tackling these issues, but also that certain protections that are codified by law and also that are less controversial, people agree on more readily, will still remain once these the aftermath shakes out. But it's definitely a trying time.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I think there are companies too, even private companies right now that are struggling that they may lose revenue based on
right.
even having those conversations. So I think we have a lot of, it's going to be a long year, but I'll pause there. Okay. So what else did we miss? Or you want me to ask the final question? I think there's so much good in here. This is a great one. I mean, I obviously, for listeners that listen often, think that, you know, talking in the workplace and revealing these things and supportive environments are really, really, really important. But what did we miss from the book, or tips, tricks?
It's a great question. I mean, I think from the book, as we talked about already, we really focus on leaders and their behaviors and like how to start. So for anyone that has a leader that needs a little bit of help on this, or is a leader and is trying to figure out how to be that supportive person, or people will open up, that the book is really meant for those folks. And I think a lot of what we talked about today is about the vulnerability piece, sharing, opening up, right? Being authentic, both from the leader's perspective and for the employees. But we didn't spend as much time talking a little bit about how do you create these solutions and what can they look like. We've had a little bit about that, but I want to just emphasize that the whole goal of these relationships is to create a person-centered plan, right? We're focusing on the person. We're not excluding the person in our planning. We've had people question if that is something that, you know, can leaders really know their people well enough to make a plan for them? You don't exclude the person, right? So I think it's just really important that when you're thinking about how do I support an employee, or as an employee, how do I get my leader to support me? Make sure that you're coming with your own thoughts, your own ideas, and feel empowered to share what would be helpful for you so that the leader can support that and they can step in to that relationship and plan with you as partners on how to create an environment that's going to be most beneficial to your needs. So I just want to make sure people feel empowered to do that when they have these conversations.
Yeah. And I would follow on that to say there are probably a lot of leaders who are listening who are also managing this on a daily basis, and they may feel uncomfortable speaking up because their organizational structure may not be supportive of these conversations more broadly. But one thing that we've found over and over again is that leaders have more power than they think they do in creating these subcultures within a culture. So you do have some span of control over the culture you create on your team. And we have stories in the book about leaders who were very hesitant to share their real struggles with things they were going through in life. And when they did, they were very surprised to find that members of their team were hiding not the same struggles, but struggles from them, because they felt like they saw them as like this perfect person who always was in line and never, you know, struggled with anything or faced a challenge. And they realized that, you know, that facade that they were putting on wasn't really helping anyone. It wasn't helping them, and it wasn't helping their team members to feel like they could feel comfortable sharing. So even if your broader organizational culture is not very open about these things, you can be open with your team and sharing the struggles that you're going through. And you might be surprised about what you get back, the support you get back, the positive emotions and encouragement that you get back. And then also just the relaxed norm on the team that, okay, we don't have to always be operating by these very strict rules and regulations.
I love it. Okay. Final question. If you had a moonshot wish for this, what would it be?
Ooh, a good one. I'm going to pass it to you, Katina. You think of these things faster.
Well, I think our biggest wish, and I mean, you'll have a different wish probably, or we should have two wishes, but I think one big wish that we both share is that organizations really get more strategic about how they're allocating their resources towards employee wellness. Employee wellness is a huge business. Companies spend billions and billions of dollars on this every year, but they don't spend it particularly well. And so our hope is that people really get back to basics of building these strong relationships, these understanding bonds between employees and their leaders, that team cultures and climate shift where there is more inclusion and people can talk more readily about these things and they're respected as whole people. And so I think what we really hope is that organizations kind of get away from this idea that wellness is a trend or a gimmick or a program and get back to basics of wellness is about having an environment that's actually supportive of your health and happiness.
I love that.
And mine is going to be, we're going to go past the moon because that's the moon. I'm going to go even further. I want the whole culture to change. Can we be in a society, in a culture where work is not the end all be all? Right, where we can have fulfilling personal lives, and that's okay. And whether or not you want to be a CEO doesn't matter, right? You're not seen only as successful because of what you do in your work, but you're seen as successful as a whole person, and really just supporting people as people in all areas of life, and not having this norm that like this hustle culture or these, you know, really intense kind of work focused norms that are really not helping people just live fulfilling positive lives.
Yeah. That's part of the plan in reimagining capitalism.
Yeah.
I think it's not going to change until we do that. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Another episode.
We went back to the moon to a new universe.
Exactly. But I'm part of that moonshot, right? So yeah. I'm happy to be on the rocket ship with you.
Awesome. We have room.
Well, great. All right, ladies, this has been amazing. If people want to check out the book, where would they find it?
Best place to go is our website. You can go workerbeing.com/book. We have lots of links to different sites that sell the book, but really anywhere you like to buy your books, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Bookshop, what have you, it will be there. So that's how you can find us. Just look up Leading for Wellness and you'll find our book.
Amazing. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
It was really fun.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie. Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.